Hello, I'm Sonny Melendrez.
And I'm Linda Melendrez.
We're thrilled to be back on Owl Radio with another show for you.
Every month, you'll find us here with two features to entertain you.
The first is called The Next Chapter with Linda Melendrez, featuring chapters from Linda's favorite books and more. I know you're going to love it.
In the second half of our 30-minute visit, Sonny shares the stories of his life and times in the world of entertainment, along with a few surprises.
So, what do you say we get started?
Let's go! Hi everybody, I'm Linda Melendrez with another episode of The Next Chapter. From captivating articles to fascinating books, celebrity news, and more, I've got it here on The Next Chapter. Hi everybody, thanks for listening. I wanted to read a little something about Rosalind Carter. She recently passed away. A really lovely first lady and great humanitarian. Anyway, here we go. This is from People magazine. No first lady since Eleanor Roosevelt in 1945 had testified before Congress, but there on Capitol Hill in February 1979 sat Rosalind Carter before a Senate subcommittee pushing for sweeping mental health services and funding, helping ensure the passage of the Mental Health System Act in October 1980. By that point, the once painfully shy girl from a rural Georgia had just become a formidable voice known for championing women's rights and humanitarian issues. "I was more of a political partner than a political wife," she wrote in her 1984 memoir. Considered one of President Jimmy Carter's most trusted advisors, she was the presidential spouse to regularly sit in on cabinet meetings. Rosalind was, in her husband's words, an almost equal extension of myself. On November 19, 2023, at age 96, Rosalind died in her home in Plains, Georgia, the same town where she and Jimmy, 99, were born, and where they first met in 1927. She was an infant. Only 2 days before her death, she began receiving hospice care following a dementia diagnosis in May. She is survived by her sons, John, James, and Donnell, and daughter Amy. They have 11 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. Wed in 1946, the Carters, at 77 years, were the longest married couple in presidential history. According to Sun Chip, the night before Rosalind's death, Jimmy sat in a wheelchair at her bedside. "My dad told her he loved her and thanked her for all the wonderful things she had done. Then he asked us to leave so he could be alone with her." From the start, the folksy, down-to-earth couple made faith, family, and service the cornerstones of their relationship. Rosalind was at his side when Jimmy entered politics in the early 1960s, assisting his rise from the Georgia State Senate in 1963 to the governorship, which he held from 1971 to 1975, to his presidential election in 1977. They left the White House in 1981 with a renewed interest in public service. They founded the Carter Center, a human rights nonprofit, in 1982, and 2 years later forged what would become a four-decade partnership with Habitat for Humanity. "She was an unwavering voice for the overlooked and the underrepresented," said the former president, Bill Clinton. Rosalind will be forever remembered as the embodiment of a life lived with purpose. Also from People magazine is this article about Meg Ryan. I love Meg Ryan. I think she's adorable. So many great movies. The Tingle. That's what Meg Ryan's daughter, Daisy, 18, tells her mom she gets after watching a feel-good movie. "It's so cute," says Ryan, who's no stranger to what she calls that feeling at the end that just makes you feel your heart open. After her big break in 1986's Top Gun, she cemented her place as the queen of romantic comedies thanks to beloved films like When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle. The writer, director, and actress, 61, also had success in dramatic films such as When a Man Loves a Woman in 1994 and 1996's Courage Under Fire. But as her fame grew, so did her determination to step away from the spotlight. I took a giant break because I felt like there's just so many other parts of my experience as a human being I wanted to develop, says the Fairfield, Connecticut native who first honed her acting skills on the soap As the World Turns. Her Hollywood hiatus also enabled her to spend more time with her kids, Jack, 31, with husband Dennis Quaid, and Daisy, whom she adopted in 2006. I moved away, she says. I don't live there anymore. It's nice to think of it as a job and not a lifestyle. And now, 8 years after her last film, Ithaca, Ryan is finally back on the big screen. She stars in, directed, and co-wrote the rom-com What Happens Later, about ex-lovers snowed in together overnight at a regional airport. Ryan, who stars alongside David Duchovny, calls the entire production magical. It's a little roller coaster ride between these two people, and it asks the question, in a way, will they or won't they end up together? There are people who broke one another's hearts way back when, and I think what is gained is that they have gratitude for that. While she prefers to keep her own romantic status a mystery, she ended her engagement with singer John Mellencamp in 2019 after they dated on and off for a decade. Ryan has embraced empty nesting, filling her days at her house north of LA with work, bike riding, home renovation, and friends. Does she now believe everything happens for a reason? Her thoughts turn to the late Nora Ephron, who wrote and directed many of her classic rom-coms. In retrospect, I feel it's true, yeah. The movies I did with Nora had an operative thing about kismet, like destiny and fate, and there's something really comforting about that. And finally, from People magazine, an article on Henry Winkler, the Fonz. Henry Winkler's cup is so full, he's afraid to jinx it. I don't have enough buckets for the overflow, he declares, as he sits in his sun-drenched family room in Los Angeles, a haven for his six grandkids. Under the TV, baskets overflow with toys. Glass candy jars line a nearby shelf, and a giant colorful couch is hemmed in by a neat row of tot-sized recliners. It all reflects the rich life Winkler has cultivated off-screen with Stacy, his wife of 45 years, and their three children, Jed, Max, and Zoe, since the star took his final bow as the scene-stealing greaser on Happy Days. But none of what led to it or what followed came easily for Winkler, described in his new memoir, Being Henry, The Fonz and Beyond. Leaving his 1950s set sitcom, he was so determined not to be typecast that he turned down Grease. The role went to John Travolta. I was dumb, says Winkler, who went on to feel artistically unfulfilled for years. I spent most of my adult life being frightened, on the outside looking like I had it all together, but mostly being anxious on the inside. At 78, Winkler is ready to pull back the curtain on his difficult childhood. His experience with severe dyslexia and what he's learned about himself through the highs and lows of his career. Those fallow years ultimately steered him toward new opportunities. He wrote a children's book, produced the original MacGyver series, and embraced against-type characters. The biggest lesson, looking back, is not only must you be tenacious, you have to take a leap of faith, says Winkler, who in 2018 returned to Hollywood's peak with his Emmy-winning turn as the insufferable acting coach on HBO's dark comedy, Barry. You just have to jump off the precipice and trust you're going to fly, because there were so many years I was not hired as an actor. I have a family. I have a house. What am I going to do? And then finally you say, ah, just shut up and try. Born in New York City to German Jewish refugees who fled the Nazis in 1939, Winkler says his upbringing lacked any tangible warmth. His father, Harry, a lumber executive, and his mother, Ilse, would scream at him, Winkler writes, and nicknamed him Dumb Dog in German, mocking his struggle with reading and comprehension and accusing him of laziness. He would not be diagnosed with dyslexia until his 30s. Winkler's relationship with his parents remained strained until their deaths in 1995 and 1998. I once tried to approach my father to say, hey, look, this is what I've been made to feel, and my father shut the conversation down. He says, I never went back with the conversation. He didn't care, and I don't care. Despite becoming a household name, Winkler privately struggled with a flimsy sense of self for decades. Adrift and anxious between roles, intellectually, I understood being authentic is being cool, but I had no identity, he says. The effects proved personal. When Stacy, his wife, was diagnosed with breast cancer in the early 2000s, Winkler admits to coming up short as a supportive husband. He fell asleep next to his wife during her chemotherapy treatments and chose to keep an acting job that meant leaving home. I couldn't process this gigantic news, he writes. A decade ago, Winkler made a decision to change. If you look up the words emotionally disconnected in any of the big dictionaries, you will see a picture of me. He decided to go into therapy. Today, I'm a more pleasant husband, he says. He also feels he became a better actor. I could not have done that show 10 years ago, he says, referring to his layered performance on Barry. Only one thing about his reputation still apparently irks him. That I'm the nicest guy, says Winkler, who over the course of this interview offered a variety of people working in his home water, snacks, his favorite burnt pretzels, perhaps some lamb chops. Bill Hader once told Jimmy Kimmel of an instance on the set of Barry where he and Winkler were rehearsing an intense scene, and Winkler goes, at what point do I tell the crew that I brought bundt cake? What I finally realized is that I'm not nice. I'm enjoying being on this earth. I'm grateful, and my gratitude makes me joyful. And that is the truth. And now, the life and times of Sunny Melendrez.
Well, this year marks the 64th anniversary of my very special guest in his musical career. Johnny Mathis has never stopped touring, recording, and performing since the release of his first album in 1956, when the world began to experience the voice of romance.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view. It's not for me to say you love me until the 12th of never. I'll still be loving you.
So a big welcome, Johnny Mathis. We meet again. How are you, Johnny?
Oh, I'm old, but never mind.
No. Now, I have to jog your memory a bit, and you probably don't remember this, but I actually met you at KMPC through George and Tess Russell.
Yep, absolutely. I remember it well.
Mm-hmm. And every year, the radio station, it was billed as the Station of the Stars. We do this big benefit concert at the Forum, about 20,000 people, and always have the biggest stars. And you were so gracious enough, because it was all for charity, and you were so gracious enough to give us your time and grace the stage with your beautiful songs. But another thing that we did every year was all of the personalities at the station, myself, Wink Martindale, Jeff Edwards, Clark Race, Dick Whittinghill. We were all on this float on the Hollywood Christmas Parade. And
Oh, yeah. And I remember
you,
now.
Yeah, you were with us. So, Johnny, I want to start out by asking you, your childhood was really very joyful. You come from a pretty big family, don't you?
Yeah, my mom and my dad, there were seven of us kids, and the thing that happened with me is my mom and my dad were my best pals. My mom was a beautiful lady, and she was a domestic worker, but I spent so much time with her. And my dad was my best pal. He's the guy that sang and played the piano, and he's the reason that I sing. So I had a great childhood with my mom and my dad.
And your dad encouraged you to take singing lessons, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I used to sing with him starting out, I guess I was about 7 or 8 years old, and my dad would play the piano and sing, and I'd stand next to him and listen to him. And then I tried to repeat what he did, and he said, "Well, son, we're going to get a voice teacher." And I said, "Well, Pop, I don't need a voice teacher. You're my teacher." He said, No. We got to get a teacher. So for 2 or 3 years, I remember my dad and I in the car driving around San Francisco, if you can imagine. We had no idea what we were doing, but we were looking for somebody to help me learn how to sing properly. And when I think about it now, it was the strangest thing. But that's the way we did. We went around the San Francisco area looking for a voice teacher. And eventually, I found one that had nothing to do with San Francisco.
This was Connie Cox?
Connie Cox, that's right. And she was in over the Bay Bridge in Oakland. And I used to go there at least 2 or 3 times a week after I'd finished my my George Washington High School, you know, duties, and take the streetcar all the way from George Washington all the way to my house, which was about half an hour. Then I'd take a bus or a streetcar over to the bridge, over to Oakland, and then get on a bus and go to Alameda.
My
it was
goodness.
Amazing what I did, but I loved every minute of it. She was a wonderful lady, and God bless her for all of her teachings to me.
All right, I want to get back to her in just a second, but then you were at the University of Nevada, and all of a sudden you had this great athletic future ahead of you. You were a high jumper and a hurdler. In fact, you broke a record over there, didn't you?
I did. That was one of the stops that we made. I went to San Francisco State, and all the colleges throughout California were involved in the track and field and what have you. And I held the record, I guess, for high jump in a couple of universities, and it was great. I loved it. I was jumping with a guy by the name of Bill Russell, who went on to become a pretty good basketball player.
Yeah.
But he was my best buddy, and we were both high jumpers in college.
Isn't that something? And then you really kind of saw that in your future, but you also had this whole incredible singing talent that you had. And I understand that on the day you were going to from San Francisco down to Los Angeles for the Olympic tryouts, you got a telegram from Columbia Records. Tell me about that.
Well, I had my two loves, athletics and music. I had a tournament scheduled as a high jumper to go from San Francisco to L.A., and my dad called me and said, son, there's a gentleman from New York that calls from Columbia Records and says that he has heard your tape or your whatever you sent to him to audition, and he wants you to come to New York. I said, but Dad, I got a high jumping competition in Los Angeles. And he said, son, I think you'd better change your mind. My dad was my best pal, of course. He is the reason that I sing, because he was my first teacher. And, of course, I turned down my chances for high jump record and went to New York and made my first recording.
Amazing.
And never regretted it.
Well, you know, Johnny, you have so many fans in Texas, and you cannot come to San Antonio often enough.
I was born in Texas.
That's right. That's right. A little small
bitty,
town.
Little bitty place called Gilmer. Yeah, and our big town close was Gladewater, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And how old were you when you left Texas?
I was about 5. Yeah, and we all got in my father's car. I don't know how, but there was a lot of us, I remember. And we drove from Texas, and it was hot. I think it was in the summertime. And we had no air conditioning. But somehow we made it all the way to California.
What is it that drives you? Because most people, they're thinking about the day they're going to retire. I would imagine that's not even in your vocabulary.
I don't know. You know, the joy of singing has never left me. My voice teacher constantly told me that. She says, you're going to want to sing all your life, so let's learn how to do it properly. Mm. And that was her big mantra as far as I was concerned when I was a youngster. And she was absolutely right. I still have all the passion that I had when I was a little kid of singing. I just love it.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful, wonderful, I should say. Johnny, what of all the songs that you've recorded, what's your favorite?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Oh, dear. Got to be Misty.
Really?
Because I just adored Earl Garner. As a kid, my dad took me to a jazz club in San Francisco called the Black Hawk. And we listened to Earl Garner from the time I was about 5 or 6 years old and played the piano. And I just fell in love with his songs. And one of them, of course, was Misty. It had no lyric at the time I heard it. But eventually, by the time I started to record, there was a wonderful lyric by Johnny Burke, a wonderful songwriter, lyricist. And I couldn't wait to record it. And I sing it all the time in my personal appearances.
Would you give us a little of it right now?
On my own. That's what I
wow.
I dream about that high note in Misty.
Wow.
Because I have to sing it every time I sing Misty. And sometimes it haunts me.
When was the last time you were in a studio recording?
Oh, gosh. It has been a while. I think I'm still signed to Columbia Records. I hope so. But it's been a very long time since I've recorded. But I still sing all the time. I go all over the world singing.
You're going to be going to other parts of the world next year or so?
I hope so. Great Britain is one of my favorite places, not only because they like my singing there, but there's some great golf over there.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got golf here, as you know, and we got to get you back into San Antonio. In fact, I'll tell you something else that happened. I love these are my Johnny Mathis stories. We have a place here. It's Tex-Mex Mexican food. It's classic. It's called Mi Tierra. It's open 24 hours. And one day, it's downtown San Antonio. I was having breakfast there, and I look over, and in one of the booths, I saw what looked like Johnny Mathis. And, of course, it was. I went over, introduced myself to you, and you were appearing at the Majestic Theater, and you had to go for a sound check. And so I gave you a ride in my car. I had a convertible at the time. I remember pulling up in front of the Majestic Theater, and you didn't even open the door. You jumped out of the car, and then just it just went right on.
Yeah, my old high jumping days. Yeah.
There you go. So when are you coming back to San Antonio?
Oh, soon. I love San Antonio, Rose, Rose of San Antonio. Yeah, I love it. The food, the Tex-Mex food, the whole atmosphere is very conducive to what I do and that singing. And I love to, keep my little hand in and singing in that wonderful Spanish language. I love it. Love it.
Oh, beautiful. Now, do you speak Spanish as well?
I don't. I don't understand it, but I love singing in it. And evidently, I've done pretty good because everybody says, oh, you were wonderful. I love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, not only that, you know, you're known not only for your incredible, wonderful hits that have, you know, gone span through generation after generation, but also you're the voice of Christmas. I would imagine that there are a lot of Christmas songs that you enjoy singing as well.
Well, you know, I grew up in a large family, and we had no money, but we had a radio, and we also had records, and I grew up loving Christmas songs, and by the time I had recorded my second song, and it became successful, I think it was It's Not For Me to Say or Wonderful, Wonderful, one of those songs, and I said, I want to make a Christmas album for my mom and my dad, and I did, of course, with the help of Percy Faith, and it really, really took off, and I love Christmas music.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
Once you hear a Johnny Mathis Christmas song on the radio, you know it's the Christmas season. It's like,
oh, bless your heart.
You literally bring it to life. And Johnny, what advice would you have about staying young and how it is you view the, because you've got this joie de vivre, this wonderful joy of life that I hear in your voice. And I told you this before we started the interview off the air, that I could be talking to you back in the 70s and you'd sound exactly the same way. Wink Martindale sounds that exact way too, and he's your age as well. So what's your secret? What advice would you have for someone?
The only thing that I recall that had anything to do with what you're talking about was my teacher says to me, whenever I got a little bit, annoyed at the fact that I couldn't do what she wanted me to do vocally, she would remind me, she says, now come on, let's do it again. She says, you're going to want to sing whether you can or not. All your life, you're going to want to sing. So let's learn how to do it properly so that you won't ever be, you know, unable to sing, and you'll do it properly. And that's the thing that I remember the most. She says, you're going to want to sing whether you can or not. And over the years, all of the ladies that I've recorded with, Barbara Streisand and Lena Horne and Ella Fitzgerald and Denise Williams and all these great ladies who are vocally so talented. And I would not have been able to do that if I hadn't studied. And that's my advice for any young person who wants to sing is find a really good voice teacher so that you can do it properly and not lose your wonderful vocal abilities.
Great advice. All right, before I let you go, you've got to give me a little bit of Chances Are.
In the magic of moonlight, when I sigh, hold me close, dear. Chances are you believe the stars that fill the skies are in my eyes. That's about it.
Unbelievable. Johnny, you are and always will be the voice of romance.
Thank you.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Nice talking to you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's our show.
Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
We'll be back with another episode of The Next Chapter with Linda Melendres.
And the life and times of Sonny Melendres.
Right here
on Owl Radio.